Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with David Courtwright. He's professor of history at University of North Florida, author of Addicts Who Survived, an Oral History of Narcotic Use in America, Dark Paradise, A History of Opiate Addiction in America, and also most recently, Forces of Habit, Drugs and the Making of the Modern World, which reviews the forces behind and the effects of the global spread of alcohol, caffeine, tobacco, opiates, cocaine, and marijuana. Welcome, Dr. Courtwright.
Hey, Jay. Good to be with you.
Now, it's a really encyclopedic, although not encyclopedic in the sense of oppressive, but encyclopedic in the sense of wide-ranging review of these drugs and their effects on the world. It's fair to say that your overall thesis is that human beings are evolutionarily unprepared for these drugs, that we have a predisposition for them, genetic or biological, but that capitalism has refined them, industrially produced them, and marketed them to us in ways that we just aren't prepared for.
That's right. The problem has become particularly acute in the last 500 years. 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, where there were only a few drugs that were scattered in different parts of the world, and people typically ingested drugs. They would swallow them, and only gradually would the drugs get into their system. You didn't have as much of a problem. But now that a wide variety of drugs are available and people have various means, such as smoking or hypodermic injection, to use those drugs, we've got a much more serious problem.
And you focus on two things. One is the science of the drugs, that drugs have become increasingly potent. We've gone from beer to spirits. We've gone from pot to Sensimilla. And also the distribution of the drugs. And you have one whole chapter about the puzzle of distribution. Can you talk a little bit about that? Why certain drugs have become popular and other drugs have not?
That is, in fact, a fascinating problem. And let me back up and say that the inspiration for this book came from a visit to a duty-free shop in an airport about 10 years ago. And I saw coffee beans from Kenya in front of me, and I saw Marlboro cartons on one side and Drambuie bottles on the other and Belgian chocolates down the aisle. And I just asked a simple question. The question was, how did all this stuff get here? You know, and why do all duty-free shops look alike? Why are the same mass-produced drug products, psychoactive substances, marketed around the world? But a kind of corollary of that question is, okay, why not other drugs? Why, until recently, for example, has kava remained a drug that's consumed largely in the Pacific? And, or cot, to give another example, why is that a drug that's confined largely to the Middle East? And the answer to that turns out to be a little bit complicated. You can't just give one answer for all drugs, but some of the answers are as follows. Shelf life is important. Drugs like cot, which don't travel well, which don't have a long shelf life, are not very useful in international commerce. Another, and I think more interesting answer to the question, is that drugs that have regular and predictable effects are much more likely to become international commodities. I mean, have you ever noticed, for example, how psychoactive drugs really don't have the same kind of market share internationally as drugs like cigarettes?
You mean like hallucinogens?
Like hallucinogens, like something like LSD, for example, or peyote. Yeah, there's a market for them. They certainly are a factor, but they're minuscule in comparison to the volume of cigarettes or alcohol or cannabis or drugs that have regular and predictable effects. So shelf life, predictability of effect, cultural biases, these are some of the reasons why some drugs caught on internationally but not others.
You also talk about, let's talk about hallucinogens for a second. You talk about the Christian aversion to different hallucinogenic substances. There are a lot of simpler societies that do, in fact, use hallucinogens in a ritual context.
That's right.
And the Christian missionaries, as they spread around the world, tried to stamp that out.
That's true. And the generalization that I just gave you about drugs of regular and predictable effects being more valued in international commerce applies largely to developed societies. It's a very different situation in a tribal society where magic and religion and hallucinogenic drug use are often intertwined in a highly ritualized fashion. That's a whole different ballgame. But, of course, you know, what percentage of the world's population lives in that kind of society as opposed to industrial or industrializing nations?
Seems like there's an interesting paradox or dual nature to your book. One is that you're arguing that that Protestant capitalism produced a lot of the modern drug problem by manufacturing these drugs in new ways and marketing them in new ways. But also Protestant capitalism shifted eventually away from encouraging drug use towards suppressing it because of the need for social control. Is that a correct interpretation of your interpretation of the modern drug war against drugs?
Yeah, I would use a slightly different metaphor. The gypsy, once it got out of the bottle, the genie, once the genie got out of the bottle, people realized, oops, they had a problem on their hands, and they tried to put the genie back in the bottle. And that's really what happened, because initially, and by initially I'm talking about 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, the profits to be made from this growing international drug commerce were just enormous. I mean, tobacco financed the American Revolution. Rum, derived from sugar production in the Caribbean, was a source of enormous revenue throughout the economies of the Atlantic world. There are lots and lots of examples of how individuals and governments profited from the trade in psychoactive commerce. But by the 19th century, it was becoming clear, increasingly clear, that there was also a price to be paid for this very lucrative commerce in premature morbidity and mortality, in industrial accidents, in the health effects on infants and children, which were beginning to be documented pretty well in the 19th century. And so people basically had to rethink this. You know, they realized that, whoops, you know, now that the genie is out of the bottle and is granted my three wishes, he's becoming a nuisance. We've got a real problem here. And that's when the controls started to be imposed. But when I say controls, I don't necessarily mean prohibition, because another part of this we need to talk about is the fact that these drugs, in addition to being valuable items of commerce, were also valuable as medicines. So the solution that evolved by the early 20th century was, okay, we're going to try to limit these drugs to legitimate therapeutic uses, whatever those are. We're going to try to keep them in medical channels and not simply let them be sold indiscriminately, even though that might profit individual merchants and governments who impose taxes. We're going to try to limit this to a medical market. And that's the modern regulatory model that you have by, say, the 1930s.
Which is also amenable to a kind of a Marxian interpretation that as long as the capitalist state can make some profit off of these drugs and shift it into this medicalization model, then they'll do that. But if the profits are going into the black economy, then it was problematic. I mean,
I don't quite agree with that, because I can see the medical non-medical distinction even before the emergence of these international markets. I mean, a great example of this is actually spirits. Spirits don't become common in Europe until the 14th or 15th century. And when they're first introduced, they really are primarily used as medicines, right? Distilled alcohol is a drug. And in fact, many municipalities in Europe in the 15th century imposed regulations. These are typically local regulations, which basically treat spirits as a kind of methadone. It says, it's like, all right, if the doctor says you need this, you can come to this place and you can have your prescription for spirits filled, and you can drink this on the premise, but you're limited to how much you can drink, and then you can't loiter, and then you've got to leave. And the same kinds of restrictions were not typically imposed on beer and wine, but clearly spirits, when they're first introduced, are being treated as somewhat problematic medicines, and the spirit of this regulation is to keep them narrowly confined to medical use. Don't let just anybody go to the taverns and drink as much distilled alcohol as they want, because you're going to have a problem. And that kind of throws a little bit of water on the Marxian interpretation, because we're talking about the 15th century, and this is in no way a mature capitalist economy.
But you, perhaps it's more a radical interpretation. I see throughout your text, for instance, your chapter on the opiates of the masses, where you talk about the ways that drugs have been used as a means of social control to entertain soldiers on the one hand, to suppress feelings of revulsion on the part of prostitutes, to subordinate oppressed peoples. It seems like you have put a great deal of emphasis on elites and their conscious or unconscious machinations around drugs.
Well, except you need to take that word elites and you need to subdivide it. I mean, for example, you have elites who are colonial administrators who are very interested in the revenue they get from the opium trade to the coolies, but you also have religious elites. You have educated missionaries who come in and who look at the situation and they're appalled by what they see. And likewise, there are medical and public health elites who, notwithstanding the tax revenue generated by this traffic in opium, don't like the human medical consequences that they observe. So this conversation, this argument breaks out among politically influential groups during the 19th and the early 20th century over what is the best means of regulating drugs, of preserving their legitimate and beneficial uses, but in some way restricting these applications or these markets that are perceived as abusive. So, and now, to make it even more interesting, what happens in the end is that the system they create to do just that privileges some drugs and not others. I mean, a really interesting question here, and in fact it's the final question I address in the book, is, okay, given that they had second thoughts about drugs, why did they impose relatively strict regimes on some drugs, like cannabis or heroin, but not on others, like alcohol or tobacco? And that turns out to be the last great puzzle in the history of drug regulation.
Speaking of Dr. David Courtwright, he's the author of Forces of Habit, Drugs and the Making of the Modern World, and professor of history at University of North Florida. One of the things I really like about your book is its focus on these capitalist externalities, the way that drug treatment, medical treatment, pharmaceuticals, et cetera, it's not just the profits that are made in the drug trade itself, which are reasons for them to become institutionalized, but also the externalities that are caused by the drug traffic.
Right.
And you have a chapter about tax addiction on the part of 19th and early 20th century governments.
Right.
Have you looked at all at asset forfeiture in our contemporary drug war? Because it seems like it's a close parallel to the tax addiction that governments had in the past, that almost all the federal bureaucracies are now have asset forfeiture funds that they have become increasingly financially dependent upon.
I have looked at that, although in the context of another book. I've also written a book about the history of narcotic control in the United States called Dark Paradise, which you mentioned in your introduction. And there I do, in fact, go into this issue of whether this policy has become a kind of parasitic taxation or a super taxation, which goes to the benefits for the benefit of these particular law enforcement agencies. And there's something to that, although it would be a mistake, it would be a huge mistake to conceive of drug regulation as merely a cynical attempt to appropriate revenue from illicit drug traffickers. It's much, I mean, regulation does have its idealistic side, and notwithstanding abuses in the application of certain laws and procedures, I mean, it still is fundamentally a progressive reform. I mean, I think that's the important thing to keep in mind. And indeed, one of the ironies of the situation is that somehow the various drug enforcement agencies have managed, through really stupid public relations, to lose the progressive sheen that they had in the early 20th century.
Let me just read the one paragraph that you have in here that addresses legalization. I'm a legalization advocate myself, and so I want to get into this a little bit. You say the extreme form of the backlash has been the call for legalization, a form of reactionary libertarianism combining elements of left and right wing ideology. legalization would reset the policy clock by more than 100 years. Heroin, cannabis, and other prohibited drugs would be legally available to adult purchasers, just as laudanum, patent medicines, and coca wines were in the 19th century. I'm sure you're aware that there are other models of what legalization could be about, and that there are many experiments with decriminalization, legalization occurring in Europe and Britain that are attempting to ameliorate the effects of drugs and put them in more of a public health model.
Sure, that's right.
And so that seems like an overly dismissive approach to me towards legalization. For instance, marijuana legalization could have a substitution effect. I mean, I guess I'm curious what your ideas would be about this, given your close reading of history, whether you believe in the idea of a substitution effect between, for instance, marijuana and other drugs, that if we were to decriminalize marijuana, it would have it would draw people away from other drugs.
Such as cocaine?
Cocaine and heroin, yeah.
Well, yeah, but there's also an argument that the use of drugs such as tobacco and marijuana, in fact, sets people up in a variety of ways for experimentation with other drugs, both sociologically in terms of who they come into contact with, and also because they get in the habit of using chemicals to stimulate their dopamine system, and they discover there are even better and more powerful ways of doing that, and they're already primed for that. These will all come under the heading of the gateway theory. In response to the general issue that you raise, I would say that the details are important. I mean, what is meant by marijuana legalization? Because every time you look carefully at a legalization proposal, you typically see that legalization advocates are saying yes, but. They'll say, yes, but we won't sell to minors, or we'll require a prescription, or even we'll require a license for you to use marijuana. And if you get in your car and drive while intoxicated under the influence of marijuana, we'll take away your license. There are all of these schemes that impose some kind of regulation or control. And the question that I always ask about that is, well, aren't people going to violate these regulations anyway? Won't there be some kind of a persistence of a black market or illegal behavior under the new regime? Because the new regime is almost never one of complete legalization. I mean, only libertarians are really consistent in saying, okay, let any adult buy or sell whatever psychoactive substance they want. And even then, they say adults. They don't usually say, we're going to let everybody do this. And the second you start introducing those qualifications, you're going to create the persistence of a black market. So if you say marijuana sales to adults over the age of 18, fine. You know, at least 40 or 50% of the usage of marijuana is by people under the age of 18. So there's still going to be a market there, a black market in marijuana sales. And then finally, just in philosophical terms, it seems to me that drugs are poisons. They are useful in certain contexts, like all drugs, like all medicines. They can be either used or abused. And in just the way that we regulate the market in drugs generally, it seems to me to be perfectly rational for governments to impose regulations on psychoactive substances. Not necessarily prohibition. I mean, I'm not in favor of the blanket prohibition of psychoactive drugs. That couldn't be crazier. You can't just make everything a Schedule I controlled substance and say we've solved the problem. But the general attempt to impose various degrees of restriction and regulation and to channelize these substances in medicine is, I think, rational and defensible.
Well, see, that's what I was puzzled by in your last chapter, is that you argue that what you call the big three, alcohol, tobacco, and caffeine, that they will increasingly be considered poisons and drugs, and that there will be increasing restrictions put on their use.
And should be. See, that's a policy of convergence.
Your argument for the policy.
That's not legalization to say that, okay, we ought to increase restrictions on drugs like tobacco, while at the same time decreasing the penalties, let's say, for substances like marijuana. That seems to be the creation of a more objective and pharmacologically defensible public health policy, but you're not necessarily just legalizing everything.
I know, but that's precisely the proposal that many of the people in the legalization movement are making.
Which is why I half agree with them. When I debate someone like Ethan Nadelman, when he says that, look, treating alcohol and tobacco as legal products and putting marijuana and cocaine users in jail is dangerous and hypocritical and stupid, I'll just simply agree with him. That's right. And so, but my response to that is that what you want to do is ratchet up the controls on substances like tobacco and ratchet them down and get rid of a lot of the trappings of the drug war and so forth on substances like cannabis.
Let me read again part of the end of your book. The movement toward restrictive categorization was fundamentally progressive in nature. Like most reforms, it was partly motivated by self-interest, tainted by prejudice, and imperfect in its execution, but its basic premise was both correct and humane. I think this is another place where where your own evidence adduced in this book might lead people to other conclusions, that a lot of the drive behind the restriction of drugs had racial and classist overtones and militaristic overtones, or the involvement in counterinsurgency abroad and so forth, that would lead one to the conclusion that, in fact, it was often very cynical. And that Nixon's attempt to control drugs in the beginning of the modern war on drugs was, in fact, a part of a Republican realignment strategy to build an alliance of working class whites against blacks and the student movement.
Well, I used the word tainted, and I thought a long time before choosing that word, and I see that you've picked up on it. If you go back to the late 19th and the early 20th century, when the international control regime was first put into place, what you see are people who are essentially progressively motivated. There was a serious problem with the too liberal sale of drugs like morphine and heroin. I mean, the rate of addiction really was rapidly increasing in the late 19th century, and these people want to do something about the problem. However, the truth is that they would sometimes use, let's call them racially offensive tactics. They would talk about, oh, the Chinese opium smokers, and oh, the crazy black men who get wired on cocaine and go out and commit these terrible crimes. And that was part of their propaganda. That was part of their strategy to persuade Congress, at least in this country, to persuade Congress to enact these control laws. Because remember, at this time, the constitutional assumption in the United States was that the police power resided in the states. The federal government wasn't in the business of doing things like making and enforcing drug laws. That was up to the states. And so there definitely was a propaganda effort or tactic that was employed as part of this larger campaign to persuade the government to impose these laws. And I simply note that, I think, honestly, in my scholarship. But that doesn't prevent me from saying, yeah, hey, these guys were right. There was a problem. There was a real reason to rethink the generally open market in narcotics and other drugs.
Looking down the road technologically, and you end on a pretty pessimistic note about the increasingly individualist and consumer-oriented society that is oriented towards the gratification of immediate needs.
Although, from your perspective, that might be a good thing.
Well,
maybe. I mean, that's what's going to ultimately lead to the triumph of legalization, not only of drugs, but of all kinds of other things that currently regulated as vices, is this consumer ethos,
You see, but I come out of the left also, and so I'm still in the left. I consider myself in the left. And so I'm perfectly sympathetic with the critique of consumer culture. It's the negative externalities in society that irks me about the drug war and the war on civil liberties. And so what I'm looking down the road towards is an increasing technological control over the brain, that we have pharmaceuticals like Prozac, Ritalin, all kinds of pharmacopoeia that are increasingly oriented towards addressing the various imbalances in people's brains, as well as the designer drugs that are coming out, which will give increasingly specialized and unique drug effects. What do you think the long-term consequence will be? Do you think, do you foresee a ramping up of our general war against drugs because of the threat? Or do you think, in fact, as I do, that the long-term consequence will be that we'll have increasing control and people will be able to ameliorate? you know, we will have more perfect drugs. So people will be able to ameliorate the negative effects of drugs by having better and better control.
Well, the problem with that optimistic scenario is that drugs invariably escape therapeutic control. I mean, it's most people would agree that it's desirable that if pharmaceutical companies produce drugs that can combat depression and various other disorders, or anxiety, like a drug like Valium, which is useful for stemming anxiety, that if a person is suffering from an anxiety disorder, and if a physician writes a prescription, and if the person uses it and improves his or her life, that's a good thing. The problem is that invariably, when you get a psychoactive drug that is reinforcing, and typically insofar as it lights up the mesolimbic dopamine system in the human brain, that drug never stays within therapeutic control. I mean, however precise it may be in its effect, you always get this popular use. I mean, that's been the pattern for the last 500 years. And that's really where the policy issue is. The use of precise drugs to combat real human illnesses is, I think, relatively non-controversial. What's controversial is this leakage into this popular recreational market, so that a drug like heroin is originally a medical drug, a drug like amphetamine is originally a medical drug, but ultimately, you know, you get this huge non-medical use, and the policy issue is, what do you do about that? You know, how do you control, how far do you go, and what externalities are you willing to put up with in combating that diversion from the medical market, because that diversion itself produces terrible externalities. You know, people die from overdose. People mess up their lives by becoming addicted to these drugs. And so the argument in utilitarian terms really is about which set of externalities is worse. Is it the black market problems or the externalities that would result from wide open market in these drugs?
I couldn't put your book down after I started it. I'm talking to Dr. David Courtwright. He's professor of history at University of North Florida, and he's the author of Forces of Habit, Drugs in the Making of the Modern World. Really want to thank you for joining us. You're working on anything we should know about?
I'm working on a history of aviation. Something completely different.
Another way to get high.
Drugs. I want to put my social history skills to I guess, a less depressing use. And so I'm writing a social history of aviation, which is tentatively called Sky as Frontier.
You didn't just do it so you could say that you're still working on getting high.
No. No, I didn't.
Okay. Well, thanks again for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
Legalize it. Don't criticize it.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.
And don't criticize. Singers smoke.